VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, we look back on the first leg of the EFL Cup semi-finals with victories for Manchester United and Newcastle United. We'll talk about Everton, who sacked Frank Lampard, but would Sean Dyche, Marcelo Bielsa or Ralf Hasenhüttl suit the club more? We look ahead to the psychological battle between Manchester City and Arsenal as the two best clubs in the country right now prepare to meet in the FA Cup fourth round. Frozen pitches are on the agenda and we'll discuss our alternative player of the month. This is The Game. Hello, welcome back to The Game Podcast. I am Hugh Woozencroft alongside Tom Clark, Molly Hudson and Gregor Robertson, all in the same building, all together, full of beans after sensational EFL Cup semi-final first leg matches, because that's where we begin, OK? Or at least I'm buzzing today because Man United won 3-0. We're off to Wembley. It's all wrapped up. Let's start with Southampton 0, Newcastle 1. It is actually 36 years since a team lost the home first leg of a League Cup semi-final and went on to reach the final. That was Arsenal back in 1987. Funnily enough, against Tottenham, Spursy back then as well. At Newcastle, aiming for their first domestic trophy since 1955. It would be a first trip to Wembley since the FA Cup final in 1999. I think they're firm favourites now to do so, Tom, thanks to that winner from Joelinton.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, from my point of view, so much has been made this season about Newcastle's defensive ability, their kind of really dogged determination in lots of matches. But I think this was another example of something that's gone a little bit under the radar, that they can play really lovely, fluid attacking football at times. Almiron, I thought, was excellent as well. And Joelinton was really, really good, not just for the goal, but his old general play in that kind of central area. They caused Southampton loads of problems, and I think probably Eddie Howe will be a bit disappointed it's not more than one. Having said that, I thought Southampton were good. I don't think this is a kind of catastrophe case of, oh, Southampton are in real trouble. I think this was another match under Nathan Jones where they showed signs of a little bit of progress this season, looking a bit more like a kind of cohesive unit on the pitch. And they had their chances. I think we don't want to get too much into the whole handball thing, Adam Armstrong's goal, but I felt a little bit sorry for them in that respect. Yes, the use of the arm accidentally has helped the ball go in, but I think it's pretty harsh and they could feel a bit hard done by in that respect. But I think Newcastle, as much as it being 1-0, it's still tight, and you're referencing those stats. I think they're comfortably the favourites to go through.
Yeah, I think so, especially in front of that home crowd at St James's Park. It's interesting to hear Tom say that he thinks there's development at Southampton, Gregor. What's your view in it? I'm slightly concerned by the recruitment, the headlines at least. James Bree from Luton Town, who Nathan Jones has worked with before, fullback coming in. Antoine Semenyo of Bristol City, linked with Southampton today as well, which for some people's a coup, but for me, I've said it before, it goes one or two ways when you start buying loads of championship players. They either defy the odds and you become, you know, they defy all the reality and become really good Premier League players instantly, or you basically buy yourself a championship team and end up getting relegated.
Yeah, they wouldn't fill me with that much confidence, to be honest. Look, they're solid players, as you say, but they need a little bit more than that. They need cutting edge. So they need someone who can score goals. Jay Adams went through, and I've never seen anyone look as, you know, less confident of putting the ball in the back of the net when he's 1v1 with a goalkeeper. But even Alcaraz, who came in, and I think he's 20. So they've got either really inexperienced players, or they're looking at, as you say, a couple of championship players there. I think they need a bit of Premier League experience. Having said all that, I still think I kind of agree with Tom. There's kind of green shoots there. There are moments and spells in all of these games recently where they've looked really kind of aggressive, playing the front foot, you know, I think they've got everything right up until the kind of that final bit of quality in the penalty box, and that's what they need. That's what they need to go out in the transfer market and acquire as well, I think.
The point I was, I guess maybe I didn't make in quite a clear enough fashion, was that I think this game, Newcastle was so dominant and so clearly the better team, and were, you know, putting together lovely passing moves, that I think previous Southamptons and other teams of their level would have been completely overawed. But they are coming back at teams. They are coming back at Newcastle. They had a go. And I know that sounds a little bit patronising, but what I mean is they had a go, and you, when you were watching it, you were going, oh, I can see what they're doing here. You know, it wasn't just a bit haphazard. It wasn't just wait for Ward-Prowse to try and bang one in. There was actual thought and tactical movement behind their attacks. And so that's why it gives me a bit of hope and confidence, despite all the points you make, Hugh, which are perfectly pertinent.
Molly, I tend to think, and this was one of the big takeaways from the game, by the way, all the big news on the game podcast, that Jacob Murphy's wave to Dueka Letesar is going to come back to haunt him. I just get that feeling. He's going to be a meme at some point soon.
Yeah, he's a meme that I should probably be using on WhatsApp because it's hilarious. I really enjoyed it. I wouldn't have enjoyed it quite so much if I was being the one sent off, to be fair. But I actually thought the manner in which Newcastle scored was literally a tap-in for Joe Linton. And I think it was actually exactly the way they needed to do it, because I did their game against Palace in the Premier League. And I wrote a piece off that on the fact that Howe's done such a fantastic job with the defence, you know, as Tom mentioned. But going forward, they've actually struggled in recent games. I think it was in three of the last four Premier League games, they hadn't actually managed to score. And then Joe Linton missed that sitter earlier on in the game, and you just wondered if it was going to be like another 0-0, another one of those kind of games where Newcastle dominated, but they just couldn't quite get the finishing touch. So I think actually it was almost perfect that it worked out in the way that it did. I think it will give them a lot of confidence going forward into the Premier League as well.
Just coming back to Jacob Murphy, I mean, I, as any listener knows, I'm a big fan of S. Housery. Mm. Love it, absolutely love it at all levels. But I did find myself thinking that this is the kind where you do look like a bit of a mug. Like, you kind of, you know, you're a bit part player in the squad. You've come on. And also the whole context of the incident itself, he runs in from miles away like a kind of weakling in the playground, gives him a shove and then runs off. And then once he's been subbed off, he gives him a little wave. Like, I know, obviously, the whole no one likes us, we don't care is very much becoming part of the kind of Newcastle narrative under Eddie Howe. And it's working for them massively. It worked for them against Arsenal. Like, the fans seem to be buying into it, but this felt a little bit gratuitous. It felt like, S. Housery to the point of gaining an advantage, great. A little bit gratuitous for me. And as I say, I agree with you, Hugh. I wonder whether it'll come back to bite him in the arse.
You loved it, Gregor.
Yeah, I did, yeah. Partly because the kind of broader context of that, like, 10-minute period, Lianco got right up in Guimaraes' face. Like, when he had him on the ground, he pushed him on the floor. They had a little set to, there was a few, it was getting really niggly at this point. So, and then Gletikar just took out Saint-Maximin. Like, he was through, probably. So, yeah, absolutely. Southampton had been given out plenty. Look, I'm trying to count how many bookings they got here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And that was, two obviously made their red cards. So it got pretty feisty. Mm. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that.
I also loved, as I said, at Manchester United's victory over Nottingham Forest, your former club, Gregor, of course. Comfortable win for Manchester United. I've got to say, they didn't have it all their own way. I'm not going to say they're flattered by the scoreline, but they'll be slightly concerned with the ease with which I think Nottingham Forest were able to break on them at times, because they did create plenty of pressure, saw a lovely finish from Sam Surridge. That's one thing, by the way, I always criticise him for. Making his finishes too hard. Sometimes you see him trying to put the ball in the top corner and he'll skew it off into the crowd. You think, low and hard, mate. Probably goes through the goalkeeper. He's so close. I've always criticised his finishing. He puts that in the bottom corner and I'm like, what a finish. Absolutely fantastic. Delighted for the boy, even though he scored against the club I support and it's ruled out for VAR. And I was like, oh, God, this bloody VAR. Just take it out of the EFL Cup completely, okay? Just let us enjoy one competition that is VAR-less, okay? But anyway, Manchester United did create plenty of pressure themselves. Marcus Rashford, 10th goal in as many games. And after that, I think you thought United were always going to win the game. Wout Weghorst got his first United goal. There was a 100th goal involvement in 155 United games for Bruno Fernandes when he added a third. That rounded things off. on a night that we now, I think, know Manchester United will be back to Wembley. So really the question is, how important is it for Erik ten Hag that he's been able to do this in his first season in charge? Or should we actually just respect Nottingham Forest and wait and see if they overturn things at Old Trafford?
No, I mean, it'd be a miracle if they did that now. That's the sadness for Forest, is that that's kind of, it's drained the life out of the tie for them. This was a big, I think it was the first time in 47 years or something. I plucked that number at the sky. I think that's right. it was a long time. And so Forest, like, they were plucky, but by the second half, it was a kind of procession, really, I thought, for Manchester United.
Do you think they were plucky? I thought they were better than plucky. I don't know whether I'm just being the kind of Mr. Positivity on the podcast this morning, managing to find joy with Forest and Southampton, but I thought, particularly in the first half, like Gibbs White and Brennan Johnson,
like, Scarpa's looking like he could,
you know,
be.
They caused
potential.
United problems. I agree. United deserved to win 3-0, maybe a smidge too far. 2-0, that felt like a kind of fair scoreline. But I'd say I thought Forest were better than plucky. I thought they, you know, again, in the season as a whole, I came out of that watching it thinking, for example, well, then no guarantees they'll go down. Like, they're in with a real chance.
No,
and
no,
Cooper's
no.
done
yeah.
a lot of really good work over the last few months.
Absolutely.
I just thought they were better than plucky.
Fair enough. But I mean, also, as Cooper said afterwards, the defending is so naive, and they had banished that. But, you know, the third goal is the one that kills it, and it was a shambles from Forest's point of view, really. So, but you also have to praise, you know, Marcus Rashford in the way that he took that first goal. It's just, he looks so, so powerful now. It's incredible. Again, you can criticise the defending. I think you could criticise the goalkeeping a little bit too. You know, he looked a bit shell shocked that he'd appeared in his penalty yard, in the penalty box. But still, an incredible run. And from that moment forth, it gave Forest like a bit of a mountain to climb.
Forest were in the FA Cup final in 91 and runners up in the League Cup in 1992. So slightly less than 47 years.
What was it, 31?
A long time.
Yeah, a long time. But I get what you're saying.
What's 47? 47 is Newcastle. I knew it was a number. 47 is Newcastle since they've won a cup.
Domestic. Yeah, 1955 for Newcastle United. Yeah. I think there were positives for Manchester United, positives for Erik ten Hag. Slightly disappointed by Nottingham Forest, but, you know, if you'd said before the game Man United are going to win 3-0, you wouldn't have been massively surprised either. Like I say, is it important for Erik ten Hag? Sad for Steve Cooper, but it gives United maybe the possibility of resting players in the next tie, which would be interesting to see what some of their fringe players will do. But ultimately, I think Forest have bigger concerns with the Premier League. Do you think this will affect the squad, affect the players, a disappointment in any way?
I don't think so. I think, like Tom said, if you watch that game, I think it shows that they've elevated from a team that was sort of odds on to go down to a team that's now, you know, fighting, more than fighting, is clear of that relegation zone. I think it was quite frustrating actually watching Brennan Johnson, because he actually got into
that was my next point.
Fantastic positions, and like, he's perfect until he gets to the end bit, and then it's like he just panics. But I think, like, ultimately when you're playing against a team like Manchester United, that's the difference, isn't it? You've got someone like Marcus Rashford who can do all of that and then has the calm, the composure, the experience for that last little bit. And I think that's probably what Brennan Johnson doesn't have yet. But I would agree that I did enjoy watching Scarpa, and I enjoy the fact that is he a skateboarder? Just seems like a really cool guy.
I did like the Brazilian huddle at the end of the game. Yeah. I think there were 6 or 7 Brazilian players just having a hug and a smile, everyone happy. It's just a game. Who really cares about the result?
Raging, fuming up in the gantry.
I like that. Anything that you noticed in this game, Tom?
I'm going to make a big, big call. Wout Weghorst signing of the January window. I'm going early.
I'm going early.
I just think...
Nice finish.
Good reactions, following in all those things you hear all the striker pundits talk about on TV. But more than that, I think he's going to bring a lot out of the United team around him. And I think that was what was one of the many, many myriad of problems with Cristiano Ronaldo, was that he wasn't that kind of figurehead striker that worked tirelessly, made runs for other players, you know, as they picked out in the... punditry of the Arsenal game. His run took some defenders away, created space for Rashford. I was looking this morning at the statistics and the average position maps for the Arsenal game and the Forest game, and despite United being a bit deeper and a bit higher at the pitch, they kind of had the same layout, which was Weghorst much deeper, playing kind of quite close to Fernandes and Eriksen, and Rashford and Antony pushed high and wide, which kind of buys into this theory of that he's going to drop deep, try and pull defenders away and make some space for the wide players to run in behind, and also give Fernandes and Eriksen passing options. Little 1-2s, play it in, move up the pitch. I think he's going to be a really simple and effective and important player. United have had so many terrible, terrible signings in terms of from the Cavanis to the Agallos, and everyone thought this was another one. I'm going early. I think he's going to do really well.
I just got to say, in terms of attitude, you know, we've brought in a lot of players at Manchester United who are maybe there for one or two seasons. He might be at Manchester United for 6 months. He looks like he's fully going to give it absolutely everything.
He loves it, doesn't he? Yeah. He's absolutely buzzing. And why wouldn't you be? Why wouldn't you be?
From Besiktas to Manchester United, I think he's just like, what's going on here?
Does no one agree? Like, I'm not saying he's going to score 15 goals and be amazing. He might only score 5, but I think he will make United a more effective unit as a team overall.
I'm intrigued to see what happens if Anthony Martial's fit.
Vehicles all the way, all the way for me. I mean, I don't think I'll be United fans. Surely you're agreeing with me. Surely.
What are you thinking about Antony? Because I've seen him live, I've seen him on telly, and I've been a bit underwhelmed.
Shouldn't have asked that.
I'm not.
This is going to be bad.
But I'm not even going to rant about it.
We don't need to. We've got Vegas.
But let me tell you something, because I was going to talk about Brennan Johnson. I might as well talk about Brennan Johnson and Antony at the same time. Like, there is coaching required. It's that simple. You know, they're younger players. They need work. They need to improve, ultimately. Brennan Johnson needs to work at getting his head up and having a look. He's so quick, and I think he's so used to just bursting away and getting a shot off with no one being close to him. He's kind of missed that layer of you need to check what's around you. You need to check back at times. Antony's the opposite. He needs to go on his right foot more often and try and go to the byline more often. He seems afraid of his right leg, to be perfectly honest, which you don't want to see because it is very readable, very predictable. And the defenders are basically lining up, horizontal to him, if you like, across the pitch, like totally square with him, saying, go on then, go on your right foot. And he never goes that way. And you've got to at least make the defender, I mean, you've played in this position, Gregor, so you can tell me, but you've got to at least make the fullback think there's a chance he's going to go on his right foot. They all know it's not going to happen. So just force him onto his left, go in for the tackle there. And he usually goes, this is the other thing, he doesn't go back into midfield, doesn't usually get a pass into a forward. He usually goes all the way back to the fullback or to a centre half. And that's easy to defend against.
I've written a piece about defending against Saka, and it's in the Times today, and it's that kind of drawing that parallel is interesting, because the biggest threat, you know, Saka's biggest strength is his kind of unpredictability. As you say, he can go, he can beat you inside. He always does. They're similar. They do the dummy and then they chop back and they do the dummy. They just try and move the defender just to create an opening, a channel either side to go and attack. Antony can go down the line. He could do it. He's got the pace over the first few yards. And the thing that Saka is so good at as well is, even once you do that, he doesn't always cross it with his right. He sometimes wriggles, because he's got the low centre of gravity, he wriggles kind of underneath almost the defender and across. Antony can do that. He's got the explosiveness. But as you say, he is too scared to face the prospect of having to swing his right foot. That's
almost,
an issue.
Almost like he needs a selfless, tireless big man next to him to play off, to come and say, it's all right, son, just give me the ball, you make the run, I'll give it back to you.
On Veghorst, I agree that he'll be a handy signing. And
he comes on the fence,
he'll help Manchester
again.
United, you know, get in the top four. But in the clutch games, in the games against the biggest and the, you know, the best teams in the Premier League, I think he'll be a weakness.
I don't think he'd be a weakness. I thought he was actually quite good against Arsenal.
Why is that, though?
He held the ball up. He brought other players into play. He helped them move up the pitch. He won free kicks.
He'll do all the simple things well. But again, you'll still be relying on Rashford or Antony. And you're only really relying on one of them just now. But you need all three of your forward men to be a threat and a real danger and someone who can score goals or create. And he's not that.
Okay, time to move on. I've got to say, though, and it's early days, we'll come to it if it actually does come to fruition. But the prospect of Manchester United and Newcastle facing off in the League Cup final is one that I'm really looking forward to. But I don't want to be disrespectful to Forest or Southampton, so we will discuss that if it actually does come to be.
And look, we skirted over the clean sheet thing.
For Newcastle? It's ridiculous.
Nick Pope, Martin Hardy's written about it. He's not conceded since November. Like, I mean, they've got a chance.
Until,
they've got a chance of winning this.
Until he faces Val Veghorst in the final at Wembley.
Yeah, no, listen, we could talk and talk and talk about that, but I think it's remarkable for 16, Newcastle. Yeah.
16 clean sheets in all competitions, more than any team in Europe.
Yeah, that is remarkable. But, you know, Rashford, he'll score. Don't worry about it. From anywhere on the pitch, he's unbelievable, et cetera, et cetera.
He'd be facing Kieran Trippier, the alternative player of last month.
Right, and by the way, alternative player of the month is coming a little bit later on. We'll talk also about Manchester City against Arsenal. We'll be talking about frozen pitches. They've probably annoyed you at some point if you're a Football League fan. Premier League fans as well at times. But up next, we've got to talk about Everton. Sacking Frank Lampard, which we spoke about at length on the last podcast, to be perfectly honest with you. And I think in the end, understandable. I know, Gregor, you weren't with us for the last podcast, that Frank Lampard was dismissed by Everton. I think we all saw that coming after the defeat against West Ham.
Yeah. Look, I think I agree with everything that you guys said in that podcast. And he's not the biggest problem at Everton, but he didn't look like he was going to be the solution to them kind of staying up this year either. So it's completely understandable, and I think they're the worst team in the league.
Okay, pretty to the point. They are the worst team in the league. I'm not sure they're the worst squad in the league, which
That's
means...
quite possibly true, yeah.
Whoever comes in has a little bit of something to work with if they can get it right.
I think it was quite damning in terms of the fact that it was like every manager that played Everton like needed a win. So, like, it ended up being Moisey that if he hadn't have won that game, he would have gone. And it sort of showed just how bad Everton were. That every team that needed to win won, and they just didn't pick up any points. But I think the worry of that is that that round of fixtures against teams that actually looked pretty winnable, especially if you look at Everton's squad, it's like, well, you've lost all them now. Those sort of golden chances to beat those around you have gone. So I think I completely understand why Lampard
lost to Bournemouth.
Yeah,
lost to Bournemouth, lost to Wolves, lost to Southampton, lost to Everton. I mean, huge opportunities, beaten by Leicester at the start of their recent bad run as well.
Literally every team that is in and around them pretty much. But it's now you're putting a manager in a position where they're already sort of... It's not like the problems are starting. They're already, like, deep, deep in the problem.
And they want to appoint a manager by the weekend, it's being reported. Their next game in the Premier League is the 4th of February, Arsenal, top of the league. I mean, no one wants that for their first game. It's at Goodison Park as well. Second game's the Merseyside derby away from home at Anfield. I mean, it couldn't be worse. I mean, these couple of games have got caretaker written all over them. Where is Duncan Ferguson when you need him? Well, he's gone to Forest Green. Okay.
That does seem like a strange match. Let's just see.
It also says a hell of a lot about Everton when Duncan Ferguson's looking at it and going, "Now I'll go to the club bottom of League One, actually. Thanks very much."
Then they've got Leeds and Aston Villa at home. I mean, it doesn't get any easier before they go to Forest. These are huge, huge games in terms of Everton staying in the Premier League. And you just think, you know, even if you get a decent coach in now, what are they going to be able to do to turn around the mood and the form of this squad, this club?
I mean, it's a huge, huge challenge. And it's why it's so interesting. Any listeners should really be following our reporter, Paul Joyce, who's been writing about this all week in such in-depth detail, kind of all the ins and outs, all the politics that's going on. It feels like there's, at board level, different choices about where they want to go in terms of what kind of manager they want to get in, which explains a lot about why you've kind of yo-yoed between Ancelotti's and Koeman's and then the Sam Allardyce's of this world. I mean, I find Everton a fascinating club. I was speaking to a friend of mine last night, and I'm going to throw him slightly under the bus because I just nodded along and listened to his views and said, "Yeah, really interesting, mate." And now I'm going to slag him off on the podcast. But you know, he's been an Everton fan for a long time, and I was asking him, you know, who do you want? And he was like, "Bielsa. I want Marcelo Bielsa. It's exciting. It's exciting." And I was like, well, you know, any listener of the podcast knows. He knows. I was like, why don't you want Sean Dyche? He's an amazing manager. Knows the league. Knows the position you're in. Knows the situation. Knows about avoiding relegation. And he was like, you know, Dyche will be in the same position. He'll keep us up. And then next season we'll be 13th or 14th and we'll be in the same situation again. I was like, mate, Everton, you'd be delighted to be 13th or 14th where you are right now. Like this is part of the problem with Everton. West Ham had it before David Moyes came in, and which is why they're a fascinating case with the whole, oh, should we sack David Moyes? Everton, the kind of delusional aspect of we want someone to build a project for the future. The project for now is to get them up a level, put some foundations in, excuse the pun, when they've got a new stadium coming, but like put some building blocks in place to become a modern football club. They're an absolute...
That's not this job, though.
No, but that's what this job needs to get them to. This is what I mean. They need to survive first, not go down, which would be disastrous, I think. Not go down. So, you know, this is what fascinates me about them because, and as I say, the reason I mentioned Paul Joyce's reporting was that in his articles, he talks about the club being reluctant to appoint Dyche, Sean Dyche, because he was seen as a firefighter. And I posted this article on Twitter using those words, and the reaction, both from non-Everton fans being like, lads, your house is burning down, you need a firefighter, to Everton fans being like, we don't want Dyche, we don't want Dyche. Yeah, and some of them who even thought Lampard did a good job, partly because, I don't know, because he's Frank Lampard, because there was an idea that they're gonna move beyond
They wanted Frank Lampard, so they kind of doubled down on the fact.
They wanted him to do really
well.
He
was their choice.
This is what I mean, and this is why it's fascinating, and it was really interesting to hear my mate talk like this, because from the outside, when I heard Everton want Marcelo Bielsa, I went, you must be absolutely joking.
Same.
I cannot believe that in any sense. And also, I don't see Bielsa taking it. I was looking at his managerial history. He's had 12 jobs. He took 8 of them in July, 2 of them in late May. He took the Leeds job on June the 1st. The only one he took like mid-season was the Argentina job in October. He, you know, he wants to have his players well drilled.
Yeah.
He must be looking at that and going, no thanks, lads.
Marcelo Bielsa is one of those reportedly on the shortlist. Sean Dyche, who you mentioned as well, and Ralph Hasenhüttl, the former Southampton boss. And I think a lot of people would feel like his football and the way things were going at Southampton would lend itself to relegation rather than to survival. But he did stay up year on year. Sean Dyche, we know what he did for so many seasons with Burnley, clearly ended badly, sacked in his final season there. And Marcelo Bielsa sacked as well by Leeds United when they were getting absolutely smashed every week. So it's not like you've got a list of managers that you think, wow, you know, I honestly believe that you should be going for the one that's kind of the best defensive manager. And just going back to your point on what this job is, for me, this job is survive, number one, and the majority of this role is to keep Everton in the Premier League and get them towards, even though Farhad Moshiri has come out to say the club is not for sale, clearly get them towards either a sale or major investment because the finances aren't there to run Everton to the point that they want to be. Remember that this stadium, Farhad Moshiri did say that would be paused if they were relegated to the Championship. So it changes the entire future of the club if they go down. But Farhad Moshiri came out to say he doesn't want to sell the club. Now, I think when you're seeing reports that Anthony Gordon's being possibly sold, Amadou Onana could also be sold, who's only just come to the club, putting some decent performances, you're starting to see, you know, basically asset stripping. You know, they're going to sell everything they can to make as much money as they can before probably they do leave the club. That could leave the club, depending on who buys them, in a really precarious position.
I think the problem for me, and I completely understand what you're saying about they need a firefighter, but take away what we've seen this season for a minute. Lampard successfully fought that fire last season. He kept them up. Now this season, like, we're back in this cycle again. So if you just appoint another firefighter, say you appoint Sean Dyche, he keeps them up this season, but is he someone that you see building something at the club? Now, the complicating factor here is the stadium and the fact that because of all that investment and everything else going on at the club at the moment, that sort of option of hiring somebody with a view to the future, of maybe even dropping down, building something to then come back up and be much more stable, you almost don't have that option because we're essentially saying it's not financially viable for a club of Everton's size and everything they're doing at the club to go down. So then, from my point of view, surely you're just entering this cycle of firefighters, keep them up, don't really get anywhere, get sacked, repeat process again and again and again. And that's also not building anything.
But I think you could make the argument that a lot of teams in the Premier League are essentially firefighting because they're all in contention at the start of the season for relegation. And so, you know, there's a bit of retrospective thinking on Sean Dyche and Burnley. They finished seventh one season. Mm. And, you know, I think it's about being that kind of Premier League team where at the start of the season, people go, are they going to get relegated? but solid enough to get to like 15th, 16th, 17th, maybe a bit higher. And then maybe one season you have an amazing run and you're like, oh, they might get Europa League. That's where Everton need to be. They think they're way beyond that.
But wouldn't your Everton fan mate say that exactly, they should be beyond that?
Exactly, they absolutely would. And that's the problem they're in, where the kind of perception of the club, and also within journalism as well, I think the perception of club in the media is big that club. They are big club and that, you know, Ancelotti came in, was going to get them to the Champions League. They are miles off that. And this is why I can see the arguments that you're making, Molly, and the Everton fans are making against Sean Dyche. They would be absolutely so lucky to get Sean Dyche. I don't get it. Gregor, back me up on this, surely.
I'm conflicted. I completely understand where you're coming from there. I think it's a broader issue about being a fan of a Premier League club that's like in the bottom half of the table, because this cycle gets kind of quite demoralising, and you don't want to just be talking about survival or playing the type of football or getting the type of manager who will play the type of football that will make you survive. Then what? They all do want to see something more. And that's why Bielsa is probably like sparking a little bit of excitement. They think, well, he will give us more. He might not be the guy who'll keep them up. That's the obvious caveat here, and that's an important one. But he would excite them. So, like, the thing that smacks me with these three names is, like, Christ, there's no imagination. You know what I mean? Like, Hasenhüttl's a good manager. We've not mentioned him. Mm-hmm. He's in the running. But again, there's not much imagination about it.
Funnily enough, when I saw him sacked, the name that came to my mind immediately was someone that was in for the job last time, Vitor Pereira, Portuguese guy who Portuguese football fans were saying he has a great style of football, his teams always improve, he's a great coach with young players. And I suddenly thought, oh, they'll just go back for him, because I think he basically made a shortlist of two alongside Lampard. So I don't even know if he's available or not, to be perfectly honest, but I thought that's the kind of manager that they'll want to revert to. And then suddenly I see these names. The most concerning thing is the styles of the managers. Quite clearly very different, all three of them. So there's no thinking about what we want Everton to be as a football club.
Yeah, this is how not to run a football club.
Yeah.
Like, they took a decision on sacking the manager on the basis of what looked like one, maybe two games and the results of those games. And now they're looking around at a few names that are recognisable, and as you say, have wildly conflicting methods and styles of play. This is how to run a football club into relegation. But the point still stands that, like, if you're an Everton fan, and as Molly says, you're in this cycle, you want something more, and Bielsa would give them that.
It's going to be a very intriguing decision. If you could name one of the three, it looks like it would be one of the three to be appointed. By the time you might be listening to this podcast, frankly, who would you go for? Tom? Dyche? All right. Molly?
I'd say Bielsa, but with the caveat that, like, he'd need to take him down and rebuild.
No caveats.
The goal is to stay in the Premier League.
Dyche, then. You're going to be in the same problem in a year's time.
Gregor?
I mean,
You can agree with me.
If the point of the neutral is to say you want to stay up, it's Sean Dyche. But if I was an Everton fan, I would go for Bielsa.
I might say Ralph Hasenhüttl, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, I mean, that's more mad than Bielsa.
He was quite good, actually, at the start with Southampton. Yeah. I feel like it's a bit clouded by the way it ended.
This is it. We were all talking about him being, these big clubs in European football are going to come and steal him soon. And there were all these things. And to be honest, his teams were quite good for a while.
What was he called? The something Klopp?
Yeah. I can't remember what it was.
Alpine or something.
Yeah, it was something like that, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But
look, Everton are 2 points away from safety. There's a blanket over seven teams, 3 points. It's not like, you know, they're not like cut adrift here. So it's been bad. It's been really bad. And they need someone to score goals. If Gordon leaves, he's their joint top scorer with Damari Gray on three. Like, they're in big trouble.
Yeah.
So they need someone to score goals. And ultimately, whoever they appoint as manager, if they don't change that, then they're down. Because they're relying and hoping and praying that Dominic Calvert-Lewin will stay fit. He's not staying fit.
Okay, all right. Listen, we'll come back to Everton, I'm sure, in the next episode of the podcast, depending on who they do appoint, if they can do that by Monday. In the meantime, we're going to be talking about the FA Cup next, a huge game between Manchester City and Arsenal. Remember, if you're enjoying all of our great journalism and journalists here on the Game Podcast, you can hear more of them at The Times. So download The Times app wherever you get your apps from.
Thank you. now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, there's no big build-up required for the first game in the FA Cup fourth round. A Friday night match at the Etihad. I will be there looking forward to it as Manchester City take on Arsenal, the two best clubs in the country right now, according to the Premier League table, who haven't yet played one another, despite the fact that they have played more than half of their games in the Premier League. They haven't yet met one another in the league thanks to a rearranged game. They will be playing each other three times in a very short space of time. But it means that this FA Cup game holds huge psychological value for the players, the fans, and the coaches as well. Will they give much away in terms of what's to come in the Premier League? And look, neutrals are going to be desperate to see this one as well, to see how good Arsenal are. I think that's the main thing on the minds of the neutrals. Are Arsenal all they're cracked up to be, or are Manchester City going to come back and thump them in the title race? I think Arsenal are the better side right now. I expect Arsenal to win this game. But the question is really on the psychological aspect. What do you think?
I think psychologically it's really interesting. In the history of the FA Cup, I think you could maybe say United v Arsenal in 99, with them both going for the title and it being at that point in the season, obviously United's treble winning season, that felt like a pivotal turning point when they got that win. But you're completely right. And because when we think about the psychological aspect, Arsenal v City at the Emirates last season was a big turning point, I think, for Arsenal fans and for Arteta, in terms of everyone kind of watched that game and went, wow, they're having a go at Man City here. And were it not for kind of idiocy from Gabriel getting sent off, they might have won that game or maybe even got a point. So I think from that point of view, you know, a year on, they're the better team in the league. They're playing unbelievable stuff. But the narrative in the chat has been like, oh, they've still got to play City. A lot of people are like, ah, City will still win the league, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I think psychologically, Arsenal's just got to be, we're not scared, verging on, we're not even that fussed. We're not that bothered. Like, I think it'd be really interesting. You know, Arteta even might rest a few.
That's crossed my mind, yeah.
Rest a few, go at them, and maybe lose 3-2 and just be like, whatever. Right, anyway, right, let's go back to the title, lads. You know, just not make it a big thing from Arsenal point of view. Just, like, have a go at them anyway. Make a few changes, bring in a few squad players, and just be like, sorry, it's Man City, is it? Okay, cool, yeah, no worries.
No,
the reason I don't think that's going to happen is because we've had a box office week. Pep came out and, like, I messaged you after that, because you were at that game, the Spurs, but the City,
Man City
City's
Spurs,
come back,
yeah,
against Spurs. Because I've been saying every week, there's always a chance that City are going to go on and win 18 in a row, whatever, like they did 18 of 19, I think, when they pipped Liverpool to the title by a point. And I texted him after it saying, this is it, this is the start of the 18 game run or whatever. And it could be, because it was a massive turnaround, and you saw Pep trying to get a reaction from his players and the club as a whole.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of context this game has been played in. And then I was at the Emirates the other night, and, like, there's no doubt that something, like, remarkable is building there. And when Arteta was asked afterwards about them being favourites now for the title, he refused to even, like, consider that as a possibility, because he said, I know too well the team who's won everything for the last 4 or 5 years. I know what they're capable of. So if they go out and hammer Arsenal, then, like, of course that's going to have a massive impact on them psychologically, because they've got to play them two more times in the Premier League.
I just think momentum here is massive. I know, and you look, you all know I've got a bugbear about Guardiola and his tactics in certain games.
Have you? You've never mentioned that before.
He's almost got the feeling that, you know, he can keep his sense of power and dominance if he loses with a massively changed team. Mm-hmm. However, if he loses this match, if Manchester City lose this match, it doesn't matter if it's a changed team. Arsenal will feel, well, there you go. We are the better side. We've gone to the Etihad and we've beaten Manchester City. If they come to our place, we expect to win that game with a stronger side. And if we have to come back here again later in the season, well, we do in the Premier League, we know what it's like to win here already. So it would be huge for Arsenal to win that game. Basically, Pep can't let it happen. So I think he has to play a stronger side. He has to go for it. He has to keep the momentum that he's been trying to build in the past couple of games. He got a hat-trick from Haaland against Wolves. He got the turnaround against Tottenham Hotspur. That honestly, he's not going to get that turnaround much. You know, a better side than Tottenham Hotspur, going two goals up in that fashion with such ease, having not really played that well. Manchester City, you're not going to turn it around every single week as good as they are. You know, I know what you messaged me, Gregor, but my feeling inside the ground was, if it weren't Spurs, Man City wouldn't have won. You know, and that's the reality.
That's your second Spurs dig on this podcast. No more. Or three strikes and
you're
out.
No, but it's true. It's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. You cannot, in that fashion, allow teams to go two goals up against you and feel that you're going to win the game.
You're right. You're saying we can't. That's not sustainable.
Yeah.
So that's true. But, I mean, still, I think it's a bit... You can't take away from the fact that they were irresistible in the second half.
They found the gears that I think could see them win all of those games that you were talking about in a row to come back and win the title. They have to play. They have to start games in fifth gear, Man City. All this, well, they found the extra gear, yeah, in the 70th minute. And it's not going to be good enough every single week. If they play top gear every single minute, every single game, they've got a chance. They don't do that at the moment. And that's why I don't think they're going to win the league.
I think it's quite interesting that you kind of point out Pep's maybe overthinking, as we've maybe referred to it previously. I think with these two particular teams, you have that extra layer of Pep Guardiola and Mikel Arteta as well, and their relationship, and the fact that essentially Arteta sort of built this Arsenal team with the same values that he kind of learnt not only throughout his playing career but under Guardiola at City as well. And I think Arteta actually said this week, you know, there's almost nobody I'd want to do this less with than Guardiola, because he knows exactly how good he is. He's seen it day in, day out for, you know, however many years. So I think that almost adds like an extra, like almost Arteta knows what Guardiola does in preparation to those games where maybe he's changed things before. So it's almost like a double bluff in a sense, because Arteta's maybe going to expect that because he knows exactly what he did in those moments. So I think it'll be really interesting. And I just can't wait to watch the three games. I think in a way, you know, we'll talk about postponed games later on, but in a way, the way this calendar has fallen has made it perfect for the neutral, hasn't it, watching it all?
You make a really good point, Molly, about the kind of back and forth between the two managers. But just coming back to kind of my cheeky point about Arteta just being almost like blasé and being like sticking in some changed players, the difference is, and Hugh, your point about Pep and tinkering, is that sometimes he tinkers in a system way as well as players. Mm. You know, whereas I think Arteta could make some changes, but one of the points about Arsenal being so good is they're such a well-oiled machine. All the players know their roles. They know wherever they play, wherever they move around, whoever they're brought on for, they know their role. So he could stick Vieira in midfield. He could rest a few players, and it will be the same type of Arsenal team. Whereas with City, sometimes, and particularly this season, as they're still all getting used to Haaland and the way they move around him and the systems, he could tinker and it could be completely car crash. So that's why I don't want him to. I want them both to play their best teams so that we can really enjoy the game. But I think Arteta could, in a kind of blasé way, not bothered, mate.
I also think the one probable fault of that Arsenal team, if you had to pick like a weakness, it is the squad depth.
Mm,
so like, if you do want to rest players, which actually I wouldn't mind, and I don't think Arsenal fans would actually mind that. You know what, if you said to them, you can have the FA Cup or the Premier League, they'd want the Premier League 10 out of 10 times. But they don't actually have, so Nketiah, without, because Jesus is injured, who else do you play through the middle? Yeah, you've got players like Vieira, who have done all right, but then someone like Lokonga, for example, in midfield has been pretty underwhelming this season. So I think he actually doesn't have that much to change it with, which I think might force him into playing pretty much as strong a team as he has, just because he doesn't have that depth yet.
But I also think, this, like I say, the psychological aspect is maybe more important for Arsenal, because the mental strength that they have built up this season, they have been working so hard on, the spirit that you need to go and win the title is fragile. because it's Arsenal. They've been hurt before. They've collapsed. No, but they have. They did. They collapsed last season. Like, it's not a different group of players. There were times last season in terms of the top four race, you couldn't believe that they weren't going to make it. I think they had, what, an 8 or 9 point lead with two games in hand or something like that. And they've still managed not to finish in the top four from a brilliant, brilliant position. And look, it's not a league game, it's a cup game. But if they lose this FA Cup game and it affects the momentum and the positivity in some way that means they then go and lose that first league match, I think there will suddenly be all this talk of, are Arsenal going to collapse? That's all I'm going to say. One of the great things about these three matches that they will play against one another is that this one is obviously on a Friday night. Good night game under the lights. The other two matches that Manchester City and Arsenal are going to play against each other are also midweek. So we are going to get some night matches under the lights, which I think we can look forward to, the drama, the audience, everyone watching. No, no one's got to look after that. They'll already be in bed, okay? There's no Sunday roasts or anything like that. You know, it's none of that. No birthday, none of that. Just a Wednesday night, solid school night. Let's get them on the TV. Let the kids stay up late if you want to. But I think it's a huge game. I think this is a huge game, and it's going to be a fantastic game. But all I'm saying is change of shape and personnel from Pep is probably what I expect in my heart of hearts, and essentially for him to throw it. Yeah, I'm not accusing him of throwing the game, but you know what I mean. If they lose because of the fact... No, seriously, what? Why have you all got your heads in your hands? He's done it before. I don't know why everyone's so surprised at me saying that.
Just because you were so measured earlier, you were like, I know people know I've got issues with Pep Guardiola, and then 10 minutes later, he's going to throw the game.
3-1-4-2 or something like that from Pep. Actually, to be honest,
I thought that was your prediction then. I thought you were saying 3-1 or 4-2, one of the two.
No, listen, I think what we all hope for is a straight shootout, right? It's a cup game. Nothing to lose.
I think we'll get a really entertaining game. And I think if you're moving us on to predictions, because I know Gregor loves them, Arsenal win.
No, City win, because it's the start of 18 wins.
Yeah, I think City win, but I think Arsenal win the title.
Ooh, okay. All right, we'll come back to that on Monday because, I'm just so intrigued to see what happens, to be perfectly honest. I'm sure we'll all be watching that game Friday night. I'll be there. Wow. Okay, I'm looking forward to it. Okay, let's move on. Lots for us still to discuss. Something that has popped up, to be perfectly honest, of late. This is a pretty interesting story that you can read in the Times right now. But it's about frozen pitches, okay? We saw a ridiculous one, Molly, in the WSL, to be perfectly honest. What was it, 7 minutes? Abandoned after 7 minutes the other day. That was a massive TV game as well. But a non-league football club chairman has accused some of his players of being more interested in beer and cake than the game. He went on an extraordinary rant. Peter Smurthwaite oversees Bridlington Town AFC and complained in a blog post on the club's website that footballers were becoming so soft that it would not be long until heading and tackling were banned altogether and that players will be playing in specially designed slippers to prevent injury. He's gone in hard. The rant was triggered by a referee's decision to cancel the club's match against Cleethorpes Town, which is another Premier League Division 1 East team, 20 minutes before kickoff because of frost on the pitch. You've experienced this firsthand, not this game, but this experience almost. I mean, your game actually kicked off. But kind of crazy with what's been going on in terms of the weather.
Yeah, I think it's probably... I don't know how to word this without being anti-non-league, which is not what
it's fine. I mean, Hugh's just accused Pep Guardiola of cheating, so don't worry about it. You
that's
can slag
true.
Off the non-league.
Follow that. So I think the part of the problem with the Women's Super League, and let's be honest, it was pretty farcical. How can you kick off a game for 6 minutes and then call it off? Quite clearly, it wasn't safe. Liverpool had complained during the warm-ups. There's a fantastic compilation video. Go and look it up, of the players just going around. It's like an ice rink. It's literally like an ice rink. They're all slipping over. I think the argument for the Women's Super League and the fact that it should be better is that it's the top tier of women's football. It's live on TV. We've got a multi-million pound broadcast deal. So it should be better than this. I think that is the issue. Although I will say that I actually agreed with some comments that Jonas Eidevold, the Arsenal manager, made this week, where he was saying that essentially we shouldn't be too emotional about it because it's sort of the topic of the day, the issue of the day. we should immediately spend, and I think it's something ridiculous, like £500,000 to have, like, under-soil heating. I think there's a lot more problems in women's football that would really make do with £500,000. And obviously that would only be for one team. So you're talking about the fact that you'd need it for, at the very least, Arsenal and Chelsea. I actually agree that I don't think it's the biggest problem in the world compared to some of the other areas in which are underfunded in women's football, whether it's research into player injuries, player welfare, which I think is a big topic that obviously we've talked about on here recently. You know, whether it's academies that aren't funded properly, aren't structured properly, we're missing out on talent. I do agree this is very much the topic of the day, but the solution is not necessarily to spend £500,000 to get one small Kings Meadow pitch under soil heating. I think it would make more sense to have proper... I mean, we spoke to Bibiana Steinhaus-Webb from the PGMOL, and she was saying that there wasn't a matchday minus one pitch inspection because Chelsea hadn't requested it. Now, if that pitch inspection had gone ahead, would the game have been cancelled the night before? Probably. Would this not have happened? Probably. So I actually think, not really answering your question, but I think it's a different argument for the top tier of women's football to maybe what it is in non-league football. But I know people on Twitter are going to say that it's relative, so I'm just going to stop talking now.
No, you shouldn't stop talking, because you articulated the point about the WSL really well in the kind of the growth of the league and the level of the players that were playing on that pitch. It was absolutely ludicrous. But I think the Bridlington Town point brings in a different point as to, you know, the weather in the UK, man, it brings us all down eventually. Like, he's talking about the position of a chairman who wants to make money and has put a lot of money into trying to get the game on. And it was interesting. It was very ranty, but he also posted pictures of the pitch looking pretty not frozen. It looked like all right. And he's kind of talking about, you know, he's paid to have the lights on, electricity bills, etc., etc. And then there's also the fan element. Like, last weekend, I got on a train at King's Cross at 10 o'clock to go and meet my dad to go to the Lincoln game. At 10:02, 4 minutes before the train left, I happened to check Twitter and they'd called the game off. Thank God, because I would have ended up halfway to Lincoln, but with no for no point. But, you know, for fans, it's incredibly frustrating. The thing that I think, you know, Molly, you touched on it there, and some of the managers touched on it with the WSL, is that we don't actually talk about the players that often when it comes to frozen pitches. And thankfully, we have a man on the show who's probably played on a few in his time. But I, you know, this, I genuinely think that, like, fans, it's never about, I've never thought about a Lincoln player when it comes to a frozen pitch. I've just thought about whether I'm going to get to the game as a fan or not. And a lot of the WSL stuff, it felt a little bit like TV money, fans going, you know, these are elite level footballers in the women's game who were playing on this pitch. Like, it does fascinate me slightly that both, at either level, the players are kind of feel secondary a little bit.
Credit to our picture editors, because on my story about this Chelsea game that got postponed 6 minutes in, there's a picture of Erin Cuthbert, who was one of the players to go over. You could see her visibly wince, and they've actually got a picture of her, like, thigh area, like the side of her thigh is all just bruised and like the skin's come off it, and all she's done is just fallen like she would normally.
Greg is sitting there with a roof of being like, oh, bunch of softies. I've played on ice before. I did.
Oh, I have, yeah. I seem to always remember Bradford City just always being icy. Always. Playing on pitches where, you know, you're doing that kind of tap 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 when you're trying to turn you're trying to change direction, you can't.
But so, to the Bridlington Town chairman point, with the players are going to be in slippers, they're a bunch of softies on the match day, are players, you know, because you played in the Football League, you must have been in there, you know, referees make the decision, but are players part of the decision at all?
Once you're there, and once you're,
are you going out and going, god, no, we can't,
unless it's
this,
like, you know, it's going to make you look like a fool or going to really put you in danger. You, once you're there, once you're stripped up, once, you know, you're ready for the game you want to play. So, you know, it has to be pretty bad, I think. I think most players would want to play. Unless, like I say, and that looked like it was one of those examples where you can't change direction. It's like, you shouldn't be out there. You always want to play. I mean, I remember going down to, like, Torquay and it being called off the next, because you have to stay in a hotel the night before, and then it gets called off the next day. You do anything to play, not to make the journey to Torquay again. And sometimes I've played in games where it kind of, it was freezing up as you played. I remember our goalkeeper at Chesterfield, Tommy Lee, great goalkeeper, long hair. They used to sing, Tommy Lee, he's got long hair, but we don't care, Tommy Lee. But he always wet his hair, put on a band. And we went out for the second half, and I remember prodding his hair. And it was like solid. It was like ice. So the game was literally, it was freezing, the pitch was freezing up and everything as you were playing as well. But you would do anything to finish it. So like, again, it's just safety, not looking like a fool, or get it played.
Okay, all right. Anyway, the players are safe. That's the more important thing.
The temperatures are rising.
Very much so. Yes, all over the world. Finally, before we go, I've just seen the nominations for the actual Player of the Month, and I'm delighted to say that none of the alternative Player of the Month nominations here on the Game Podcast are included. So it works. The whole premise of this article works this month. Fantastic. And none of the players we've gone for are that good either. So let's start with you, Gregor, because you have pulled out the biggest of them all. I mean, usually you go for a player who's playing very, very well, and it's kind of like, oh, they probably should have been nominated for Player of the Month. This time around, you've cottoned on to what Alternative Player of the Month is all about. Go ahead.
I'm going for young Hugo Bueno, the Wolves' left wing-back, 20-year-old, who Steve Davis gave a debut. He'd worked with him in the academy for a couple of years, and when Steve Davis got the interim role, gave him his debut against Forest. He's not looked back. I think he's played every Premier League game since. Really quick, neat and tidy on the ball. Great cross on him. Got a great delivery, and he's got an interesting story too. In that he, Wolves kind of stumbled over him on a scouting trip to Vigo in Spain in 2018, just by chance, and invited him for a trial.
How old was he in 2018?
In 2018.
How old is he now?
20.
So he's what? 16.
He joined the academy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's been Wolves academy until this season. And so he took him on trial and he impressed, and he was a winger or a number 10. And he's also got an identical twin brother, Wheely. I'm not sure that's how you pronounce it. Anyway. and he plays for
Didn't have the name in, but
he
okay.
he came on trial afterwards. They brought him on trial, but by this point they'd both kind of he'd switched to a left wing back role, and his brother's also a left wing back, and they're kind of like, he's a really good player, but they thought this would be ludicrous to sign another player. So he's signed for Dortmund, and he's playing in Dortmund, wow. Dortmund's second team now. And yeah, I mean, imagine they've got two identical twin brothers who are playing exactly the same position, and are both kind of on the verge of making a breakthrough. And I think he's been outstanding, a real bright spark for Wolves in a difficult season, and even after Steve Davis's step back into the academy and Lopetegu's taken over, he also seems very impressed too. So Hugo Bueno, one that you guys, let's be honest, hadn't even heard of.
I'd heard of him. I knew he played for Wolves, but I couldn't have told you which position he played.
So definitely alternative.
Molly?
I have gone for Mikhailo Mudryk because...
You, like all the other pundits, were impressed with that 20 minutes, were you?
Right, so this is the 20 minutes that makes him slightly less alternative, right? Well, given that, so you've seen him play now, seen he's quite good, but it just adds to the absolute drama. So it's January, love it, bit of transfers as long as I'm not involved in it, in which case I hate it. But absolutely nailed on, going to Arsenal, gets on the old social media, you know, a gunner. He's got pictures of Arsenal in the background of his, you know, TV on his Instagram story. Everyone's adamant he's coming to Arsenal. And I just think this sums up the sort of modern, you know, when players sign for a team, they're like, I've always dreamed of signing for this team. But to sign for Arsenal, you might believe it. Then about 2 days later, he signed for Chelsea. So for the absolute S-housery of that, he is my alternative player of the month. And even better, he could actually be the player of the month next month because he looks quite good. So Chelsea have won that one, got one over Arsenal.
Now, I was going to go for Wout Weghorst, but I've decided that he's almost certainly going to be my alternative player of the year. So I'm going to save that back and keep it for the end of the season. I always do this because I just love the idea so much that I have so many ideas pouring out of me. Kepa Arrizabalaga gets my honourable mention for the month, but he's genuinely playing quite well and he's done all right of late. So.
He's not.
Yeah, he's been rubbish.
No, I see. Well, there you go. He would have been alternative. Maybe I'll pick him. But no, instead, I'm going to go for Danny Ings. Why, you ask? Well, he scored a pretty important goal for Aston Villa in their draw with Wolves earlier in the month. Then managed just to get his third big money move of his career, despite, I don't know, for me, never actually being that good. Scores a couple of goals early on in his career sometimes, like look pretty sharp at certain points, but generally is not a sure thing. Despite what David Moyes thinks when he said when he signed him and said, "Yeah, this guy guaranteed goals," so guaranteed that this is a little shout out for my brother who put him straight into his fantasy football team. Oh. And made him captain, only to see him start on the bench for West Ham in his debut. Come on. And then, brilliantly, pick up an injury. So there you go. A goal, a fantasy football captain, and a big money move. It's been a big month for Danny Ings. Has to be the alternative player of the month.
I have gone for Brighton's young striker, Evan Ferguson. This team has been crying out for a number nine for years, and they have found the solution. The best thing about his game is keeps it simple. He's not a young player trying to impress on the entire world what a great player he is. Play it into his feet, he'll give it back. Get it wide, he'll get in the box. He'll throw his head at things. He's old school with a little bit of quality as well, and you can understand why he was spoken about for so long. Well, I say for so long. For those inside the club have been earmarking him for so long to be a player in the future, because everything that we've seen so far, it's essentially what we've wanted to see from Brighton for so long. And we thought, are they going to sign a player good enough to be able to do that? They haven't needed to. They've brought a player through. He's fantastic. I know you want to say something about him, Gregor. I can see it in your face. No? And that is why I have chosen him as alternative player of the month.
It is a good shout. I mean, let's be honest, yours is the best shout by a mile. Ours are all a bit too alternative, aren't they? Really?
Yours too definitely are.
Yeah, mine and Molly's are just plain weird, let's be honest.
So, yeah, so I'm going for Evan Ferguson to have a brilliant end to this season, and he will be nominated for Alternative Player of the Month, if not Player of the Season in the real world, very, very soon. Anyway, that is the end of the podcast. Thank you all for listening. Gregor Robertson, Molly Hudson, Tom Clark for being great company. Remember, you can get more of our great journalism at The Times. Download the app. If you want more of the podcast, just hit that bell, the notification button. You won't miss an episode. And you can subscribe to The Game at thetimes.co.uk/The Game. We'll see you on Monday.
Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.